알고 있네요. 베니누.
아이고. 이러빌라이에 나야 한와키에 다세 이노이즈에 투데 싱가네 댄스네 피포데 리조이스에 마 브로다 마 시스타 러비 투데 이피구두 오바디에 맥퀴데 탱거디에 바바 곧 나야 한와키에 이러빌라이에 노빌라이에 러비 에브리버디 Why sleep for night to wake up, see the light, yeah. See the future is bright, yeah. I need the enter for I, yeah. Make you do your best, yeah. Baba God go handle the rest, yeah. Even if you no get money, yeah. They jolly, they shake body. No need to get your body. If it no be God, way. Last one be dead body. Nobody be no baby. When you fall, you go stand up again. You try him again, again and again and again. Cause it's all easy, yeah. Oh, oh, oh. To the singer, the dance, and the people, they rejoice, yeah. Oh, oh, oh. My brother, my sister, love you today. Oh, oh, oh. If you go to a party, you make with the tango, yeah. Baba God, now your hand working, yeah. I see my people, yeah. On a good day. Nobody wake up for this world to suffer, yeah. Than a bad day. Now you come today, another man tomorrow. My brother, which kind of life with this? Everybody getting always to follow. Try, but you know easy, easy. Even if you don't get money, yeah. They jolly, they shake body. No need to the dead body. If you know be God way, that's when baby dead body. Nobody be the baby. When you fall, you go stand up again. You try him again, again and again and again. Cause it's not easy, yeah. And they dance and the people they rejoice, yeah. Oh, oh, my brother, my sister, love me today. Oh, oh, if you go to a party, you make with the tango, yeah. Baba God, now your hand work, yeah. Bring it back.
Thank you.
right, at this time, what I would like to do is bring Chimurenga Waller up, and he will deal with the 1010 community organizing process. We kind of switched that with President Walia Brooks, who was going to be doing the Feed Ourselves project, the food bank. And so, you know, without further ado, I want to bring Chimurenga up to talk about how we're going to get into these communities, and that this is where it's going to become very important with, you know, with, again, those applications that you have to fill them in, because everybody lives somewhere, and we want you to be the person, a point person in your community. So, Chimurenga.
Uhuru, comrades. So, as Gaita said, I'm going to be doing a PowerPoint on the 1010 organizing program. This is really important because we talk about gardening, and Gaita mentioned the child care collective work that we're going to be doing. But the 10-10-10 is a way that we actually consolidate ourselves in these communities and create what we call liberated territories. So we actually got people that we can name to say, these are our forces in a 10-block area. And each one of those blocks will have a, yeah, you might not need to dim the lights a little bit, okay?
You mean
the
turn? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, flip off. So we're going to turn the lights off so we can see it better. Uhuru. So it's called Block by Block, City by City Tactics and Strategies for Organizing Liberated Territory. And it's pretty straightforward. And the logic here is to organize people in every block of this city where we can. And then in a 10-block area, you would have a block captain on each one of those blocks. And when we consolidate a 10-block area, we would then have a section, then that section would have a section leader. So in short, that's what it's about, but now I'm gonna go through some of the details of how we get there. So the program is block by block, and this was a NPDOM program that we presented at the party's Congress. And the objective is building revolutionary organization to occupy political space, winning liberated territories. Some of the people in the room might have been at this press conference that we did in Uhuru Park. It used to be called Silver Lake Park, right near Silver Lake Park. We had a number of people there who were talking about some of the issues. The sister in the pink dress is a sister named Debbie Newkirk. She's going to be working as a block captain. She's a little preoccupied now. Her brother actually got shot by the sheriff's department, but these are some of the people who were engaged in the press conference that we did in the park, and that acted as a real mass education for the people to help us start wind forces to be block captains and create liberated territory. Next slide, please. So again, it's block by block. These are some of our organizers. Everybody probably recognizes Fenty, who is from Sierra Leone, and Johnny Brinson. They were out selling the spear and doing postering. And this is part of the way that we get people contacts and also get people involved in the block by block. Next slide. Next slide. Cooper. Okay. So we have to be able to mobilize groups of people at one time, bring science to organizing the people. And that's what the block by block, city by city is about. That's what the 10-10-10 program is about. So we're in the process here talking to some of our forces, giving them an overview about going out into the community. And that's how we get the block captains through various methods of outreach, door-to-door, doing drops at these meetings. One of the people who came to this meeting today is a neighbor of mine. He is a landscaper. He's interested in the community gardening. So this is the kind of thing that we can be winning people to in terms of the block-by-block organizing. Next slide. Next slide. So we have to create leadership in the community. That's what the concept of creating liberated territory is about. You get a person who, like Debbie Newkirk, and you say, can you organize your block so that becomes an Uhuru block? Our ideas, our work is concentrated in that block, and that block becomes our political territory and liberated territory. So Debbie Newkirk is just one person. Curtis Sykes is going to be doing some more block captain work. We have to deepen the training of the block captains so they know how to take this work out into the community. Next slide. Next slide. So we have to control what happens in our community. That's part of the basis for creating liberated territory. Because it's not liberated territory if you can't control what happens there, right? So we want to control what happens in our community. This is an actual part of a video from the scene where this brother, Denaris Green, got arrested by the police for protesting their treatment of this younger brother. So we have to be able to be there with our video cameras. And if we have every block organized, everybody is going to be prepared to get that stuff documented and to resist the kind of actions that the police carry out against our people on a day-to-day basis. Next slide. And conduct mass education. And you saw the press conference that we did in St. Petersburg. This is actually in New York, Brooklyn, New York, I think. At a mass political education where the meeting was actually held outdoors. People came to that meeting. I think it was about 14 or 15 people out there at that meeting. So mass political education can be conducted in a number of different ways. It can be done in these kind of settings like we're doing here today, or even in an outdoor meeting at a park like they were doing at that meeting in New York. Next slide. So we have to organize the entire community. That includes women, students, workers. Got a little error there, got workers twice. Prisoners, everybody has to be organized into the block, 10 by 10 by 10 block organizing program. Next slide. So the primary method, again, is the 10-10 block organizing strategy. And again, the block organizing strategy, we get one block captain on each block, and once we get 10 blocks consolidated with block captains, we then organize a section, what we call a section, and then that section will have a section leader. So it's organizing as these many organizations, these satellite organizations all over the city are now Uhuru Movement organizations. And some of them might be organizing around gardens. Some of them might be organizing around the child care collective. But our two main things that we are targeting now is the child care collective and the gardening. And, of course, we're going to be doing the food program a little bit down the road. But we organize the 10-10 program around these programs. That's how you get people consolidated to be prepared to bring that program to their community and organize the people right there on that block. The block captain is really important because that's the person that the people know right there in that neighborhood, and they're responsible for delivering those people to Sunday meeting, doing house meetings at their house, maybe doing a community meeting at a neighborhood center that's near that block. These are the kind of things that the block captain will be doing. Next slide, please. So the 10-10-10 block organizing strategy was brought to the U.S. by James Forman from Guinea, and he brought it to the Black Panther Party.
James Forman from SNCC, he was in Guinea, he brought it from Guinea to the Black Panther Party.
Yeah, the chairman is very familiar with him. He was a very important figure back in the 60s. Next slide, please. Thank you. So we have to grid the city, and this map here, while it's not totally gridded, I'm going to be talking a little bit about identifying target areas, and you have to have a big map like this so you'll know the areas that you're completing, and you start shading them out once you get them completed. But you use these little push pins, and that will represent a person. This one is actually at my address, where I live. I'm going to need two because brother that left, he lives right above me, and he's interested in doing gardening. So we're going to try to be organizing these 10 blocks, of course, and then we'll have a section once that gets consolidated into the block. But we have to identify a target area. You start out, this little red area is where we
identified 22nd Avenue to 11th Avenue in St. Petersburg. And that was the target area that we started out with. Of course, to get the whole city, you have to move your target area. As you can consolidate different target areas, then you have to move your target area so you can start expanding that area out. Next slide, please. So the block captain is the most basic form of leadership. He or she organizes everyone on the block into the block organization. So the block organization is holding block meetings. They're holding socials for the people on the block. They're doing political studies. They're taking people out to sell the burning spear on their block. But these organizations are essential to doing the block and section work that we're talking about in the 1010 block organizing strategy. Next slide, Kafir. So the structure of the block organizing process is one block captain per block, 10 blocks per section, and one section leader per section. So you got a 10 block area. By the way, 12 blocks is a mile, so you're almost talking about a mile square where you got one block captain on each one of those blocks, and then you got the 10 blocks now equal a section. Once you got 10 block captains, you create the section leaders at that point, and then you got a section organization. So you got the miniature block organizations inside the section as well. Next slide. How to recruit block captains and section leaders. Next slide. So these are some of the methods of outreach we use, and some of these we're very familiar with, doing door-to-door, developing a contact base, and then following up with what we call the sales process. We're not going to get too deep into sales. I only got about 30 minutes for this, so I'm going to only be going through about 30 slides. But the door-to-door work is going to be really important because that's one of the ways you get a chance to have a discussion with somebody. Tell them about the garden program. Tell them about the Free Child Care Collective. And we can be talking to people about the Free Child Care Collective and the gardens. Sometimes people might not even want to do that work, but they might have a neighbor that might be interested in doing it. Somebody across town. If somebody across town that they know is interested in doing it, that helps us. Because it also helps us create another block captain in another area where we can now start expanding to another area. Next slide, Kafir. So this is what we were actually doing in Tampa, organizing for the party's six-party Congress. This is myself and a brother named, calls himself my nigga, and he's kind of interesting cat. But he has a little group of homeschool children that he goes with. They were helping us do block work in terms of putting up posters. The walkthrough is postering at the same time you're engaging people along the postering route and getting contact. So we were doing that work over in Tampa. That was back in December. So next slide, please. So this is another way that we do follow-up. After we get these contacts, we have to do phone banking. And this is something that's required to do within a five-day period. After we get these contacts, we have to follow them up. So even when the follow-up call doesn't work, we have to go visit people. So what that means is when we're getting these contacts, during the process of trying to get the block captains and the section leaders, it's going to be important to get all the contact information. Do not get partial contact information. I know sometimes people will say, well, I don't want to give you my phone number. I don't want to give you this or that. But if it's at all possible, our objective is to get the complete mailing address, emails, phone number, Facebook. We want all of that. You don't want to just get a partial contact. So it's really extremely important, particularly phone numbers, as we go through the phone banking, and we'll talk a little bit about some of the ways that the phone banking is effective. Next slide, Kafir. The weekly mass rallies at 4 o'clock on every Sunday. The International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement does the mass rally, and that's a way to get new people into the block organizing work. We're going to start a process, so every week We'll start putting those little push pins where your address is, and we're going to be asking people to take on those blocks where they are and training them how to help bring people to the mass rally, carry out the program to get people involved in the Free Child Care Collective, and also get more people involved in the community garden. I think this gardening thing is going to really be big, because I think everybody recognizes it's going to be more and more a serious problem with the acquisition of food in the African community, because we cannot live on no food stamps. That is not going to work. Obviously, if the government isn't in control of it, you know they're going to take it. Just like they so-called gave it out, they're taking it back already. So we want to use the 10-10 block strategy to get people consolidated so we can do for self and start building these programs like the Free Child Care Collective and the gardening. Next slide, please. So we want to train the people who we get to be block captains. Once they volunteer to be block captains, they have to be trained. And that doesn't mean just throwing them out there and say, go do X, Y, and Z. What that means is what we were doing here, actually showing people this is how we do the postering. This is where you want the poster located. You're trying to get pedestrian traffic or vehicle traffic. So we want to get the ideas of the organization out to the community, so those ideas of our organization become the ideas of the block captains or the section leaders of the section organizations and the block organizations as well. So we have to train people so they don't get demoralized. They don't know how to do what we asking them to do. We have to train them first, show them through observation and participation. So we need to hold meetings on the block too, not just at the Uhura House. We need to ask the block captains to look, can you organize block meetings where, and it doesn't have to be at the block captain's house, it can be at anybody's house on the block. As a matter of fact, if it's other people other than the block captain, that may help consolidate other people in that block. But I think meetings around gardening, meetings around the Free Child Care Collective are going to be extremely important in helping consolidate these kind of house meetings that's away from the Uhura House to really get people consolidated into these programs that we're talking about. Organizing section meetings. Of course, the section meeting would assume you have now consolidated the 10 block captains in that 10 block area where you got the 10 block captains. Now you got a section leader. Now you start organizing the section meetings as well. Next slide. So how to build a section. They identify the target area. I just talked about the target area that we laid out in red. Our target area was Martin Luther King, the 16th Street from 22nd Avenue South all the way to 11th Avenue South. And you continue to work that target area to so the people get to know you. They know who you are. You're doing door-to-door, knocking on doors. And then that's how you develop the process. That's one of the ways you develop the process of getting and identifying the section leaders and block leaders in the communities that we're going into. So this means training them as well. So we have to train the block and section leaders on all the outreach methods that we carry out. On door-to-door, section meetings, how to hold a section meeting, how to do the phone banking, how to do that effectively, how to do collective phone banking with groups of people making phone calls, and how to get people to the weekly rallies, and also how to do the house meetings. I don't want to leave that out. How to do those block meetings right there in their communities. So these are some of the activities and responsibilities of a block and section organizations. We want them to be writing for the Burnsville newspaper. That is the newspaper of the African People's Socialist Party. And we want them to write and sell the Burnsville newspaper because we want articles from right there on the block. Yeah, we had a Burnsville study on our block on 15th Avenue and 19th Street. Seven people came. It was a really deep discussion. People really were deepened by the discussion, X, Y, and Z. It ain't got to be no complicated article, but we want those kind of articles in the Burnsville newspaper. That would help us push it into different areas. But also people like to see themselves and the results of their work in that newspaper, and that helps us sell it. So we want to do want to teach them drop outreach. That's trying to do that outreach by speed, but you know exactly where you're going in the target area, leaving a piece of material on each door. Then the postering outreach, and you're doing those posters because you want that poster to stay up so people to continue to ride by it and walk by it, and they know what kind of work we're trying to do in terms of building the free child care collectives and the gardens. And the tabling outreach is also important. Tabling is another way that we get a chance to have discussions with people and actually get them engaged. Next slide. So we carry out the sales process, and this is follow up with contacts within 5 days and making those and enter those contacts into a database. These are different kind of databases. It's databases that they call list boxes that are databases just of emails. But of course, I talked earlier about getting the complete contact information, because we also want to have a database where we got physical addresses, phone number, so on and so on. Next slide. So I think this is the 35th slide. And it says recruit, 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 recruit. And it says recruit into the African People's Socialist Party, into the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement, into All African People's Development and Empowerment Project, in the Uhuru Solidarity Movement, and forward to the NPDOM Convention. That's going to be in September. Can you go to the next slide, Kafir? I want to see if it... this is the outreach slide. Go to the next one, please. I want to talk a little bit about the outreach, yeah. And it says, why do we do outreach tables? And it has specific objectives for why we do this kind of outreach. The gain contacts, so we get all the information provided, and we want to provide information as well so people know how to hook up into these programs, selling the Bernie Spear and the merchandise that the organization might have, and also the most important thing is to win membership into our different organizations. So this is another form of outreach called soapboxing. And soapboxing is a way to get on the street with a megaphone and just start putting out our politics, put out our programs, and we're handing out flyers at the same time that that's happening. And we're directing people to a table where we can actually get contact information. But this is a really high visibility method of outreach, and it's a really important method. Sometimes we call it four corners. You may have heard us say that before, where we have people on each intersection, and we're doing that same piece, soapboxing at the same time. We're passing out flyers to cars that stopped at the stoplight. Next slide. We also do drops, and all of these methods of outreach is what we have to train the block leaders and section leaders on how to carry this out. This could be a flyer or door hanger, club cards, leaflets. Drops are placed on the doorknobs between the doorknob and the door jamb of every house or apartment in a designated area. Of course, the designated area is called the target area. And then we have the maps printed so we know where we've completed, because the logic is to continue to get those block captains so we can get those areas to be liberated territory with our ideas, with our programs consolidated on every block. Next slide. So we want to saturate the area. We want to recruit lots of people and move quick and minimize. When we saturate an area with drops, this is more related to the drops. This is to move quickly and minimize while the engagement with the people is minimized during drops. The quantity of the outreach, the quantity of the saturation of the area is what we're concentrating on when we're doing the drops. So the amount of material is more emphasized than necessarily engaging people. That's not to say we don't engage people, though. So we want to be secure when we're doing this kind of outreach. We want at least two people on each street. those people can keep eye contact with each other. We want to keep security at a maximum and be sure that we keep eyes on each other so that people are not getting lost going inside people's houses. Then I don't know where you're at. So we need those people to keep eyes on each other. Everybody be secure. And that way we continue to be successful with the drop method of outreach and get out the amount of material that we set goals for. So the goals of the door-to-door is to collect vital information for the organization, invite people to the weekly rallies, events, etc., and to recruit members. We can recruit door-to-door. That's going to be really important for us to get better and better at that, to ask people to join, because they won't join if you don't ask them. So door-to-door is a really important way to consolidate the kind of programs that we're talking about, both the gardening and the other program that we're talking about, the Free Child Care Collective, and, of course, the food program is going to be coming up in a few months. So next slide, please. So postering gives us a lot of public exposure because we don't just do it in high-traffic areas. We do it inside the community as well, where you got lots of foot traffic. This way you don't have to make 20,000 copies to get visibility. You can make a much bigger piece. Of course, 11 by 17 is the basic poster, but it allows more and more people to see it on an ongoing basis when you put those posters up. So postering is really important as a way of public exposure for the organization and also constant exposure as you, of course, when you pass out a leaflet, sometimes people just toss it, sometimes they don't read it. But the poster stays up there, so you're kind of getting that constant exposure over and over again. So I think that was the last slide for this process. We will be going more into the sales process. I mentioned a little bit about the follow-up earlier in earlier in the PowerPoint, but there's a lot more slides to go, but I want to just stop right there and really appreciate people's attention. But what we want to do is really get people organized into these blocks, doing block work. And by the way, this map is of St. Pete, but I know we got people from Tampa and outside of St. Pete, and we can do the block by block in any city where we are. That's the logic. So if you're from Tampa, don't feel like this, I'm not talking to you, because I am. And I want to make sure that everybody gets consolidated into the block work, and we talk more and more about getting these programs out to every block in this city, in the cities next to this block, and also all around this country where we're going to be consolidating that, mainly through NPDOM. But again, APDEP, all our organizations are going to be doing block by block, 10 by 10 by 10 work to try to consolidate the programs that we talked about earlier. So I want to express appreciation to Conrad Gaeta.
What about Stockholm and the United Kingdom?
Yeah. Thank you, Chairman, reminding me about that, because this is an international program. We can take it anywhere. It can be taken to Germany. It can be taken to London. So the block by block, because there's blocks in every city in the world. So Sierra Leone is going to be getting involved in block work. The people in England, the people in Germany, all the forces that we have need to be getting involved in the block work to bring on forces, consolidating those blocks, and then consolidating section leaders as well. And the logic is to bring contacts to members, and then members to cadre, and cadres to leaders. So I want to express appreciation for everybody's attention, and I just want to get a real consensus and see how many people are interested in helping us do this block work. And I don't mean just in St. Pete. Anywhere you are, if you're online, if you're out of the country, if you're in England, London, we really want to get people involved in this block work and get people on board. So you can send, I know you can send us an email or through the chat room, but you can also sign up right there at the table. We already have your contact information, but we want to make sure that we sign you up for the block information before you leave here. Uhuru.
People got applications, so could I see a show of hands who would be taking on their block, even if it's your building? That's Bruce, Lothalo, Ona.
Me.
Are you taking a name? Me. What's his name? I got a blank on you, bro. Crown. Jesse. Anybody else? At this point, what I want to do is to go into the African People Free Chapter Collective.
I think you need to speak to the mic.
Yeah, I'm just going to get this. You had a leaflet for the African People Child Care Collective. Everybody should have gotten one of them. And I think this is one of the important programs. Chimarenga just spoke about the 1010 program. That's one of the programs that we're implementing right here. And we said in the beginning when you came in that we're about organizing this community. We are about organizing wherever we are. And so that we have decided that there are two programs that we can immediately do. One of them is the 1010. We're going to be doing that immediately. And the other program is going to be the gardening program. And then from there, we're going to be talking about the Child Care Collective, because we think the Child Care Collective is going to take us until August to be able to get on the ground. But there's some work that we want to begin with it, you know, with it now. Need to get the lights.
You look at your screen, I'm controlling this.
I'm looking at the lights. My screen don't have what you have. Oakland and Toronto, great. All right, Uhuru. And Walia will talk more about that when she comes on. The African People Free Child Care Collective is born from the 14-point working platform of the African People Socialist Party, which point number 9 states in part, we want an end to the political and social oppression and economic exploitation of African women. The African People's Free Child Care, the African People Child Care Collective challenges the manner in which the form of the family has been distorted. The notion that the child is the property of the parent, as opposed to the African tradition of the child being the ward of the community, is foreign and alien to the African culture. As you can see there's this popular African proverb that we hear all the time where it says it takes a village to raise a child. And this saying was originated in the Igbo, in Nigeria, and Igbo and Yoruba tribes. But as they searched through Africa, they saw that it is a custom. This is something that is found in several places, even though it's a little bit different. It has the same meaning. In Eastern and Central Africa, the saying goes, one hand does not nurse a child. And in Tanzania, it says, one knee does not raise a child. In Africa, inherent in the African understanding is the value of community, unit, cooperation, sharing, caring, and the survival and well-being of the whole community, as opposed to one individual at the expense of the whole. In Africa, children are considered a blessing from God to the whole community, not just the property of its parents. Therefore, the upbringing of a child is a communal effort and responsibility. Currently, the condition of existence for African people in America and around the world is colonialism, a system whereby a foreign and alien power kidnapped us from our home in Africa and enslaved and dispersed us around the world for profit. Domestic colonialism denies us the right to be free and independent people, to have control over our lives politically, economically, and socially. Manifestation of the consequences of a colonial existence can be seen throughout our day-to-day lives, and there's a number of statistics that we can see this manifestation of the loss of power over our lives. In the U.S., 27.4% of all Africans in the U.S. Live in abject poverty, and this comes from the National Poverty Center. In Pinellas County here, in St. Petersburg, 75% of the African on the south side live below the poverty level. 21.5% of African women with children living under the age of 18 live in poverty. 21% of the African male students in Pinellas County schools graduate with a standard diploma. One third of all African students graduate with the standard diploma. Every year that a black students stay in Pinellas County school system, their achievement go down. In 2000, a study was done by a PhD statistician, Robert Bardwell, and he suggested that the chances of the failure of African children not being related to racial disparities was the same chances that you would have in winning the Colorado lottery 12 times in a row with the same ticket number. In 1998, Pinellas County School Board studies showed that 43% of black kindergartens were not ready for first grade. By the time black students reached the second grade, 58% were failing. They came in, 43% weren't ready, and by the time they reached the second grade, 58% were failing, which proved that some of the children would have been better off staying home as opposed to entering the Pinellas school system. Why do we see this kind of disparity? Why do we see, you know, African women raising African children by themselves, single mothers? There's 846,000, or 42% of African men in prisons in the United States. And every 28 hours, an African man has been killed by police or white vigilante acting as the police. And on top of that, with the advent of social welfare programs, any semblance of the African cultural glue as related to the communal responsibility for child rearing, which held the African community together, was stripped away. The imperialists distorted the form of the African family, promoting that the child was the property of the parent and codifying that premise in government welfare programs, which in the absence of jobs became necessary for women to sustain their families. Welfare demanded that in order for African women to get any so-called public assistance, it became necessary for African women to disappear their husband and separate themselves from the support of their extended family and community, thus becoming an individual isolated from the community and with the sole responsibility of rearing their children. This created a very alienated and oppressive situation for African women who now found themselves cut off from the lifeline of family and communal support, which was replaced by a hostile, dehumanizing, oppressive government welfare system who now became their husbands. Today, the same system demands that in order for African women to receive any help for their children, they must turn into the state, the names, and whereabouts of the father of their children. Failure to do so could result in the denial of food and shelter for the children. African women are forced to choose between food and shelter for the children and the father of their children. This has created an artificially imposed antagonism between African women and African men, pitting one against the other while leaving imperialism, the enemy of both, off the hook. The African the African Child Care Collective is the solution. The African People's Child Care Collective offers our communities an opportunity to mobilize the entire community in its interest in a manner consistent with our culture and around the question of which brings out the best characteristics of our community. The Child Care Collective, in addition to providing child care so that mothers can be free to take care of our different needs, we seek also to provide health care for the children. The Child Care Collective will also organize, will also be organized as a freedom school to expand the mind of our the minds of our children and enrich the cultural life and provide a, provide nutritional programs for the children and their mothers. The African People Child Care Collective will allow our entire community to share in the dignity of knowing that we have reassumed the responsibility of taking care of our own children. The mission of the Child Care Collective would be central to the mission of the child care is the education of the mothers and the members of the community and the children as to our glorious national homeland, Africa, our culture, who we are as a nation of people in the U.S. and dispersed around the world, and our historic mission to free and unite our homeland and our people. In addition, our mission is to restore our cultural understanding of our communal responsibility to raise our children. A description of the Child Care Collective. The target group for the Child Care Collective are African single mothers and their children in particular, and the entire African community in general. The organizing premise, the collective will organize on the premise that mothers will bring their children to the collective initially for 5 days, but will have to contribute 1 day a week to the collective, thus they will be freed up for 4 days. The age group of children that we are talking about, the age group of the African children are as follows. From year 1 to 3, the age group would be 6 months to 5 years. So we say from the first year to the third year of the existence, we will take African children from 6 months to 5 years old. In year 4 to year 7, the age group would be 6 months to 6 years, kindergarten slash first grade. You know, some kids go to kindergarten earlier and first grade earlier sometimes. In year 8 to 10, grade 5, age group 9, we would have grade 5, and the age group would be from 9 to 10. And we would be evaluating in year 8 the ability to move upwards by year 10. The goal would be to move from elementary to middle school by year 12. The number of children, from the opening up to the first year, a pilot group of 20 children, a quota, there'll be a quota. There'll be children from 6 months to 12 years, we'll have 5 of those. We'll have children from 12 months to 2 years, 5 of those, and then 10 children that would be between the ages of 3 to 5. And this would just be a pilot program. The staffing that we would need for such a project, we would need a child care coordinator. And these are positions that I'm hoping that people would be talking about, you know, today in this meeting, because we want to call a meeting pretty soon right after this. I would announce that. But we would need immediately to start at the level that we're talking about, child care coordinator. We need a project coordinator. We need economic development specialist. We need a grant writer. We want to have grants. And we need a teacher and 2 teachers' aides. So that is what we would be looking at to implement that. The Child Care Collective will create a safe, loving, stable environment that is conducive to growth, trust, and well-being of the children, and a sense of security and trust for the parents. The hours of operation will be from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Mothers participating in the collective would participate in the collective 1 day a week, and make sure and they will make up the staffing for the collective. So that means that the way that it would operate is that everybody that brings their child to the Child Care Collective, they have to give a day. You're freed up 4 days. You give a day. So, mothers will play the roles of clerk, teachers, cook, lobbyists for the resources, fundraisers, teachers, aides, janitors, and organizers for the collective. They will work to secure the majority of the resources and skills that is needed for the child care. And monetary resources needed for the effective functioning of an establishment of a free or at minimum cost to the working class African single mother. Now, ideally, we want to see a free child care collective. Ideally, we did a pilot program similar to this in Oakland in the 80s, mid-80s around. I can't remember the exact time. But it was free then. It was a free child care collective, and we worked off a little grant. But if the parents, if the mothers, and it's not just mothers, when we say the community, we mean just that. Primarily the mothers are going to be participating, but brothers and sisters and elderly people in the community and retired people in the community and uncles or whatever, that we need the whole community to be participating in this process. And for it to be economical, because we're targeting a special group of women, it means that we would have to get a lot of the resources would come from within the community. Mothers will be required to organize in the community using the 10-10 organizing method to win retired community members, those with skills and without skills, men and women, teenagers, other family members in the community to participate in a child care collective. And you don't even have to have a child in a child care collective to participate. You can volunteer in the collective if you live in the community. We are assuming responsibility for all the children. The collective will target members of the medical profession, doctors, nurses, dentists, obstetricians, pediatricians, to participate in providing health care for the children. Now, in the Oakland Child Care Collective, we had such a thing. We had doctors, we had 36 doctors that participated in the projects that we did, and we had a rotating doctor that participated in the Child Care Collective, and it was quite different, because a lot of the parents remarked that they had been taking their children to emergency rooms and even to doctors, and they hadn't never encountered a kind of relationship that they encountered with this physician that, you know, that we had at the Child Care Collective. And first of all, it was unconventional. The thing that we, and it was based on unity. We had to win this person to unity, you know, with the project, which meant that anything that happened in the Child Care Collective could not go to the state. No matter what she found with the children, it was not something that could take to the, that would be taken to the state. Because we knew some of the contradictions in our community. We would deal with it. That's what it means to assuming responsibility for ourselves. This was, you know, this was our liberated territory, and this is how we operate on there. That was number one. So that, and then the kind of relationship that she had, the physician had with the children, the pediatrician, was that the mothers were present, and everything that she wanted to do and everything that she found, and she had to relate it to the mother, and the mother had the opportunity to ask questions and participate in the treatment of their children. So it was quite a different kind of relationship, and I think it can be done because we saw, you know, the outcome of that. So we would be trying to win across the board the kind of skills, you know, the kind of skills for our children. And not only are we talking about medical skills, but we also looked in the community and whatever that we could come across in terms of skills, whether there were people in the community that were linguists, that spoke several different languages, that, you know, we recruited people to participate in bringing that to our children. So the children were exposed to just about whatever their capabilities were in terms of absorption and to get this, you know, this understanding, the children were exposed to it. So there were no limits on what they could do. The collective would promote and train the children and parents in healthy eating and exercise to begin to impact on the diets and health of our people in our communities. We will be continuously organizing to get access to skills, languages, expand the curriculum, and develop our children's capability. We will educate our children around their colonial reality, involve them in demonstrations, protests of our people, involve them in resistance, and teach them the security consciousness, community preparedness, and survival techniques for themselves and for the African community, and that is important, you know, in terms of involving the children in the reality. Imperialism does not spare our children. It attacks everybody in the community. Children, from the time they're born all the way through, everybody gets attacked. So the children have to understand that colonial reality, and that's one of the best things that we had going for us in the Child Care Collective. We had a thing called Circle Time, and it was amazing the questions that the children raised. I mean, it was amazing. Children raised questions like, why we don't have any daddies, and why are all our daddies in jail? And I mean, they wanted to be engaged to understand the question, and we would give them the colonial reality and help them to understand it. They went out on demonstrations. Every demonstrations that we did, the children went. They had their placards. And if somebody put a mic in their face and asked them, they would tell them why they were there, because they were taught and they understood it, and they participated in the people's struggle. So we think that's what it means for us to treat our own children, you know. And in fact, if we're talking about, you know, the collapse, and our children need to be well aware and alert. It's only when we leave them disarmed that they become victims They need to be well aware and alert of what's going on, so they need to know how to be security conscious. They need to know how to community preparedness. They need to know. They need to participate in the gardens. They need to have their own area in the gardens that they cultivate. They need to know about food, what can be eaten and what can't be eaten, so the children would go through the same experience. The goals and objective. The goal, one of the goals is to end the special oppression and isolation of single African women raising children by themselves. The Child Care Collective would strengthen the community, transform the lives of the women and their children, transform the community, and allow the single mothers the opportunity to retrain themselves and participate in the pro-independence struggle of their people. Goal number two is to mobilize the entire African community's own interests around the collective rearing of African children. Afford a community to share the dignity of knowing that we have reassumed responsibility for our children and community. Goal number three is to free up single African mothers to allow them to pursue education if they choose to do so, and to participate in taking responsibility for their community. It would empower the women and the community. And goal number four is to provide freedom schools to expand the minds and enrich the culture lives of our children. We will educate our children in their own interests and contribute to enhancing their life in their own community. There's some things that we need to do immediately in terms of the procedures. We need to finalize this, the POA. We need to establish Child Care Collective Coordinating Committee, identify the grants, and develop a more detailed economic plan to raise resources for the child care. We want to identify the location, the venue that the child care would exist in. We establish the budget, recruit an individual to pursue and write the grants for the project, develop the recruiting strategy for recruiting into the African People Child Care Collective, develop the administrative protocols, develop a curriculum and registration that and testing process for the children, develop and execute the strategy for recruiting teachers and other skills needed for the child care, develop research and establish the leadership structure, develop the training process for staff, acquire the materials that we need to begin the Child Care Collective, and establish the child care menus. And we have some timetables here. We want to convene the first meeting around this project on 2/15. And that means that I'm hoping that there are people in the room with children that would want to participate in this. And people online, we are saying the same thing to you. You have to get to your form, fill it out. And NPDOM will be collecting those forms to see where we have people like, you know, that we can identify. We have to get we have to implement the Child Care Coordinating Committee, and that's what I would like to do on the 15th, depending on who we have to volunteer. And we have a leaflet. We're going to be going out into the community with the 1010 to take this project out. But if there are people here involved, and like I said, it doesn't have to be sisters, brothers, anybody in the community that would like to participate in this child care, you might be able to participate bringing some skills. You might be able to participate in bringing the children exercise. You might be able to do art projects. This is our children, and they need access to these kind of things. But we do need to get, so you need to put your name down on your form and then say, how would you like to participate? And then we need to get the committee started. I have a bunch of deadlines here in terms of phase one, phase two, et cetera, about it. The next step is to convene the meeting with all the people from the conference who is interested in participating in the African People's Child Care Collective to attempt to fill out the structure that I'm talking about for the coordinating committee. So I'm at the place where we need a coordinating committee. And, you know, in the mid-1980s, around 1985 to 1986, the African People's Socialist Party built a pilot program of the Free Child Care Collective of about 15 to 20 children, ages similar to the ones in this plan. Some of the children were labeled troubled children, and the kind that would be anesthetized with Ritalin here today, you know, if they were here today. We use a method described here to include organizing language classes from volunteers in our community who spoke French and Swahili and other languages. We use love and attention and created a comfortable teaching environment for the children. We catered to the so-called hyperactive kids by giving them more advanced responsibilities, and they thrived. The children participated in every demonstration that we saw fit to allow them to participate in. They were clear on the issues and they were able to articulate them. The pilot lasted only 3 years because, like today, we had a tremendous amount of work and too few people to take on the leading the program. Upon entering public school after the pilot program, every one of the children excelled. The teachers were asking what school did these kids go to. Today, we had one of our children graduate with a bachelor degree in molecular and cellular biology and speaks. She speaks fluent Spanish, French. She reads and writes and speaks Japanese, Mandarin, and Wolof. She got exposed to understanding language and appreciating language, and that's Kenya's daughter. You know, and it came from the Child Care Collective. She was one of our first children. So we're saying we can do it. You know, we're saying we can do it. And we know we can do it. What we need is you. You got your children suffering in those schools. You got your children in the community that are not your children, but they are your children because the village raises the children. And so this is the call to all of you to participate. You know, we talk about we want to end the oppression of African women. This is one way. This is a practical way. This is one of the most vicious ways in which African women are attacked because it locks them down and they're not able to do anything in their own interest. And sometimes we hear of African children that are abused, not because the parents want to abuse them, but the conditions are so hard that people cannot cope sometimes, and sometimes people snap, and the children gets in the way in terms of that they want to get the brunt of the whole question. We need, as a community, we need, when we look at the failure of our children, when we look at the kind of statistic, we got children going into kindergarten. They went into kindergarten bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and had the ability, and by the time they got to third grade, they dummied down so that they can't do anything. That is a crime. We're killing our children. So we're talking about the whole village. It's time. This is where we begin. It's time for the whole village, you know, to take the responsibility to raise our children. In doing so, we would succeed in empowering and raising and securing the standards of the village and the future of the whole people. Malcolm X told us a long time ago that we are the only people who sends our children to our enemies to get educated. And I think that saying goes today. We have to do something about it. We need, you know, the call is to let's build the African Free Child Care Collective. Let's snatch the future of our people into our own black hands. Mm-hmm. So again, I want to see the forms. It's time to put your money where your mouth is. So I want to see the hands of people who can think they can participate on any level in the Child Care Collective. This is where we just, you know, we turn the tables on this issue, you know. And if you don't want to talk to me now, you can talk to me in private. You can say, this is what I can do. People got skills in here. Good. Could you write, sister? Lucky you can teach them gardening. I'm going to stop calling y'all name if you don't want to put your hands up. I'm going to call you out. You're going to have to talk to me. Damon, you can teach martial arts, so whatever. Something, push ups. Life, you can do something. You can teach them poetry. All right. Miss Camlider, you can do something. And Miss Sue Wells. I'm just calling names. Just calling. You don't call me, I call you. The Thalo, you and your son can teach him art. You know that it would be criminal for you to walk out this door and not teach our children how to be artists. You know that, right? Okay. All right, we appreciate those who, I'm going to be hounding you. I got your numbers. That's how I got you here today. Okay, so what we want to, at this point, I want to bring in President Walia Brooks, and she's going to talk about the Feeding Ourselves Project. I just want to say to Sister Yapo, who is one of the people that put her hands up, we probably could meet around this. I have a meeting date, and I want to see if I can get more people, but the meeting date is the 15th, and we can talk about that. Is Comrade Walia on? Walia is going to talk about a Feeding Ourselves Project, a food banking and hot meal project. Is she there? President Walia? Okay. President Walia is in, Newark, New Jersey. And this is a dynamic young sister and full of life and energy. So we should have a lively discussion. And one good thing about this program that Wally is talking about, it all meshes because, you know, Aisha talked about the garden, planting the food, you know, and Wally is talking about hot meals. So it seems that it's such a natural thing that you can have the garden sending food over to the hot meal place. And she'll tell you more about that project, but I think it's got so much potential, and that's one of the projects that we want to start here. We think that this is one that we can do immediately. You know, it wouldn't start out with the hot meals, but there's a component of it that would allow us to even get to the place of the hot meals even, you know, easier. So I'm going to let Wally, I don't want to give her a presentation, but I look forward to this presentation. One moment, Sandy. You want me to call somebody else, Sandy?
No.
Uhuru, Conrad.
My name is Walia Brooks. I'm the interim international president of NPDOM. NPDOM, which stands for the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement, is the mass organization of the African People's Socialist Party. And our goal is to organize Africans and to become self-determined people and win liberation in our lifetime. And I just wanted to say that I fully unite with all of the speakers who have gone before me. I think that these programs are very necessary in this time period. As stated, with the crisis of imperialism, and also through the empirical data that Penny has presented to us. And I think that this conference also presents very material ways that we can start building these programs now, as with the case of the community garden and the community childcare collectives. Today, I'm going to talk to you about establishing a community food program through food pantry. Next slide, please. Our goals and objectives. So our goal is to build a community infrastructure in case of an economic collapse. Then we will have different services in place to feed the community, organize the community by providing basic services. Also, at the same time, we are organizing the community to be self-determined, liberated territories and to bring people into organized revolutionary struggle. I did a little research. So based on the Community Food Bank of New Jersey's website, 1.2 million people in New Jersey alone are food insecure. That's a new term that I learned, food insecure. And of those people, 45% don't qualify for food stamps. So this is only in New Jersey. So imagine the national percentage of people who are food insecure, quote unquote. And although there wasn't a breakdown of hungry people by race, but most likely there's a high percentage of Africans affected by this phenomenon. As far as food stamps, with an economic collapse, the food stamp will be utterly worthless. Organize African food banks and lead the African community. Okay, so water and food is the most basic need of the community. If people are hungry, then they cannot focus their mind to organize. The only main focus is for them to figure out where the next meal is coming from. Based on the crisis of imperialism, as explained in Chairman Nomali Yeskitella's political report to the 6th Congress, and the empirical data presented by Chairwoman Penny Hess, the time is now to be on the offensive of this issue and lead the African community in ways to sustain ourselves. So now what? By establishing community-based food banks. I was doing my research, and this is initial research, but from what I found, in order to establish a food bank and get food from food banks in your areas, you need to establish a nonprofit. You need a safe and secure storage for the food, volunteers to distribute the food, reliable transportation to transport the food from the food bank to distribution points or to distribute the food throughout the community, and also monetary donations. So the first thing is to establish nonprofits. The Hoover Movement already has two nonprofit entities, APDF and ABDEP. In order to receive donations from the food bank, we will have to be set up as nonprofit organizations. So what does that mean? That in areas where we don't have ABDEP, we will have to create, we will have to build up this program because we already have an established nonprofit. Safe and secure storage for the food. When we do receive the food donations, they will have to be secured. Food houses where we are located, that we have full control and supervision over these precious resources. That is why it's imperative to establish a food houses wherever we are located. We also need volunteers to distribute the food. There has to be a call for volunteers to distribute the food. It can be a fair exchange. You put in volunteer hours to help distribute the food. You can get food packages as well. We can recruit volunteers by using the 10-10 strategy as laid out by Tim Moringa in his previous presentation. We also need reliable transportation to transport the food from food bank to distribution point or to distribute food throughout the community. And we also need monetary donations. Money will be needed to sustain the program. Money for transport, housing, and distribution of food. And we can also apply for grants. The bigger picture. So that's just the initial way of having a community food pantry. But once we have areas that have gardens and enough food stockpile, we can ask for donations of food from the community to feed the community instead of relying on entities such as community food banks. There's also a term called gleaners, and these are people who go to restaurants and supermarkets or orchards or farms, and they go with the purpose of collecting food that's not used by the owners. The goal is to create community gardens and stockpile food enough for ourselves and the African community at large. So now what? How will we get people to come get the food? We have to spread the word. We have to get in the community using the 10-10-10 recruitment strategy. As Shimarenga said, we have to do walkthroughs. We have to knock on doors. We have to leave propaganda in people's door jams. We have to get volunteers out there ourselves to bring people to the food. And we also can lead people to our food banks by having mobile distribution sites. How do we bring people into organizations? So it's one thing to bring people to the food, but how are we going to bring these people into organization? Once people come for food, we will have them fill out an info sheet and give them propaganda on what the Hulu movement is about, any upcoming events, welcome them to weekly mass meetings, etc. If we are feeding folks, they will be more inclined to come out to our weekly mass meetings. Now we have a base of contacts from the community that we can call upon. Over time, we will have a natural defense mechanism. No one will attack us. We will remain unscathed. If we are feeding the community will protect us. Over time, we can expand to have a hot food program, a farmer's market, food storage, but we will need food donated by food pantry and community garden, a place to store the food and cook the food at a hoo-hoo houses or commercial kitchen, volunteers to cook the food as well. We will use volunteers from the community food banking program and also offer a fair exchange. You cook food, you can eat food as well. What can you do today? You can be a part of this program and any of the previous programs discussed by joining NPDOM today. Director of Membership and Recruitment, Shindy Watu, and Kianga, the NPDOM Membership Secretary, are in the chat room today to get your contact information. You can also click on the link provided and fill out the form. What else can you do today? You can be a part of this program and any other of the previous programs discussed by donating today as well. We all have our roles to play. Some can do outreach. Some can volunteer, while others can donate. Here is your opportunity to donate today. We need resources to carry out these programs. Invest in your community. No donation is too small. Uh-huh.
Ready to ask questions. We have one more workshop, and this is on community security. And that's Brother Kubina. Sandy, is Kubina anywhere in the vicinity? Oh, so you don't have between the two. Over 70 and we are. Jesse, can anybody tell us how over 70 we are? I'm saying that because the last thing we had, we were 70. If we come past that. Yeah. Well,
shops. I think everybody should be experiencing the benefits of this discussion and the workshops that have happened up to now. One thing I wanted to mention is that while we, you know, can look at the question of grant writers and things like that, I don't think that we should build a program that's dependent on that. I think those we can make these programs happen without grant writers. And so I don't think it should be central to what it is we were going to do. I know at one point when we were talking about the issue of Child Care Collective in an open meeting, perhaps it was at the Congress, there was somebody who was with us who was saying that they could do some things in terms of making some resource happen. I think that's fine, but I don't think it should be grant dependent. That's one thing I would like for us to consider. Another thing is that we should remember that the party and the Black Panther Party itself were able to build these food programs, free child care collect, free breakfast for school children. We've done free food programs here among ourselves at different times as well. And that the way these food programs were handled is that we struggle with the corporate supermarkets and things like that who where Africans shop, spend money, et cetera, to contribute to these programs, to the point where we were able to be highly suggestive to them that it's in their own economic interest to do this. And that can be associated with the question of the 10-10-10 program, where we're organizing people who can demonstrate an ability to impact the income of supermarkets who simply just take money from us and don't want to give anything back to us. And I'm saying this because while we do have some nonprofit corporations in the Uhuru movement, I don't think you have to have a nonprofit corporations to get the food, the resources. We can go there just like we do some things even right now. We are able to get certain kinds of things from corporations, and I think we could even be much more effective in doing that. Remember, we're saying that dual and contending power. So we are a power in contention with another power. We are a power in contention with the existing system as it is. And so it's not just asking them for some charity and stuff. We're asking them for a return on our investment, that the African community is spending money in these, in Walmart and all these other places, and they have a responsibility to reciprocate in terms of giving something back to the community. Not just the Walmarts, I'm talking about the Arab merchants in our communities and various other joints. And I'm talking about even Africans in our community. If you're going to make profit out of our community, then you need to contribute something back to the community. Anybody in the community is taken from the community needs to be able to. So I think that that's really important for us to understand. So you don't have to have a nonprofit, and I don't think you have to have grant writers. But think about it, if we're talking about dual power and we're talking about self-determination, and self-determination is organized around getting a grant. You know, that, in my view, you know, is not something that we're about. And I'm not saying that if people come running to us to give us grants that we should reject them, but I'm saying that we can't build programs of self-determination, self-reliance that depends on that. Other thing is, in terms of the work, I saw a successful program in Tampa that was organized by either some petty bourgeois or perhaps even some kind of poverty program thing that I was impressed with, because they fed people on a regular basis. And when I say fed them, I mean they had set up where people can come in and eat and be fed, you know, like at the tables and decent meals. And they used volunteers to do this. And these were volunteers, a lot of elderly sisters were the ones who did the cooking and, you know, et cetera. And I think there are people in our community who will be willing to participate in programs like this. And sometimes many of the recipients, the primary recipients, might have been elderly African people as well. But we can have that kind of program, and it can be a community program. People can come and not just, you know, like they do you know, at some of the religious things that call themselves food this and food that, and be subjected to something that's hot foreign. They can come and have community, be with community, and you know, we can collectivize this process of repairing some of the damage that happens to our community in advance in the struggle. So I would just like for us to consider some of this as we, you know, like are moving forward and further with the discussion of these programs. Are we ready for Corbina? Okay, I'll get out your way, Comic. Secretary General, you want this?
Ooh.
Okay. So, I mean, if Corbina is on, we can just put...
Uhuru, comrades. This has been a very powerful conference, and I think it's, you know, definitely a well-needed conference. And I mean, I was when asked by the party to take on this task, I was really excited about it, and looking forward to taking on this community security and preparedness portion of the conference. And I really unite with everything that's been put forth so far in the conference, and really looking forward to seeing the work that's going to come out of these programs and winning the masses of our people to these programs to advance this revolution. The first thing is next slide. Is that... in securing our community, I think the chairman mentioned earlier, you know, the best security for internal and external problem issues in our community is that we have the masses of African people organized into an organization to work in the best interest of the whole community. And, of course, we know that that is the African People's Socialist Party, organizing the masses of the working class into the party or a party organization that's going to work in the best interest of the movement. And that's by far the best security that we can have, because if we collectively working together, not only can we resolve our own issues, but we can also deal with external issues and the state, you know, intervening in our community as well. Next slide, please. And we know the other thing is that in organizing our community, some of the issues that we have in our community, as this crisis deepens, we see that the pressure on African people without, like was mentioned before, there's no jobs, there's no resources, and it puts us in a very desperate situation. But as we organize ourselves, as we're going out and implementing the 10-10 program, as we're doing the community garden, as we're doing the various programs that we're putting forth in this conference and that we have been doing, one of the things that we have to be able to do is to organize something to the effect of a community commission. And this helps us to resolve contradictions in our community, and resolve contradictions in our community that it doesn't end up in a violent situation or an African losing his life or anything like that, where we really, you know, be able to address horizontal and vertical violence in this process. And but internally speaking, having a program like this to end horizontal violence in the community, or, and not just violence, but even able to resolve, you know, community disputes. And we know that this is possible because we've seen it as a party. We've seen it throughout, you know, the African world. When you look at local community courts, that when one sector or individual in the community has a dispute with another one, they bring it before a body that they can resolve that contradiction and be able to resolve it in a way that's going to benefit not only them but advance the community itself. And we're going to be looking into more ways to provide more structure to that. And presently we're looking at you know, like I said, other African resolution programs that have worked in the past, as well as like Cuban local courts that have been successful at resolving local contradictions, community contradictions, and our own program that we have done in St. Pete, where we even put out a DVD around End Horizontal Violence, when we were successfully able to resolve a contradiction between Jordan Park and Bethel Heights, and something else that we have to be able to do in this process is to create like central locations within the community, even in organizing the 1010 block, even within that 1010 block, having a peace zone where if there's issues in the community, there's one place like on the Hool House that people can come to from even from opposite sides of the question can come to and know that this is a place that we're going to come to issue. Bring it here. I mean, have to see this commission as that type of organization. People in the community that I respected dearly, well, that would either be, you know, the party unit where people look up to, or even having a fraction of the party within that commission that can guide that commission, that will make sure that we provide leadership to that commission to work in the best interest to resolve these contradictions. Next slide. And in securing our own community, you know, something, you know, to provide a little structure to a program like that. And a lot of the programs will have to be implemented through some of the, in the process of what we're doing, like the 1010 organizing strategy with our mass organizations and organizations that will actually take these programs out into the world and organize the, as we organize in the communities, organizing, you know, these programs where people can begin to respect, and similar to what we did with, again, like we did, if I'm not mistaken, I think it was like 2008 with the situation in St. Petersburg and other situations that we've been involved in. But the community, ideally, in these areas, where we have a community commission, you know, it would consist of like a mediator, which, you know, in imperialist terms, it would be considered like a judge, a court reporter, and four leaders in the community representing different sectors of the community. So it's not like one section or the is represented, but everybody can feel represented, and that is going to be a just and a just conclusion that we come to. And that will have to be, you know, grievance policies that we set up and organize to make sure we follow, you know, protocol and processes, and the commission will be responsible for resolving the conflict for the advancement of the community. And the courts must also bring the state on trial for the crimes against our community beyond just our internal issues, but having tribunals that we can also charge the state and hold the state accountable to, you know, the crimes that they commit against the community that we're involved in. Next slide. This also leads us to securing our own community and keeping a black eye on the state. And we done have various campaigns as well in the party and in PDOM that are responsible for organizing block leaders and block and blocks and organizing campaigns where it's we actually intervene when the police come into our community or the state on any level come into our community to organize the community to push the state out or organize our community to make sure that we observe everything that's going on and document what's happening. But we want to make sure that we engage in making sure if they come into our community on any level that we are working in the best interest of our community and preventing them from being able to just come through our community at any given time or for any reason. And next slide. And the black eye on the state has to consist of an agitator, a recorder, an organizer of the people, and a videographer. We want to make sure that we document all these things, not only for propaganda usage, but also to be able to have someone responsible for if when the state come out into the community, that we have somebody that would go, whether we got to go door to door, whether we got to, you know, get a bullhorn running up and down the street to make sure that we bring the people out into the community to observe what's happening. And we want somebody to record what's going on. We want somebody to videotape what's going on. So we have to, in our 1010 process, organize these forces that this is what this is their job. Anytime the state comes into our community, we engage them. We have to have an agitator. And there's roles and responsibilities that each one has. And an agitator, you know, is the one that engaged the police in a way that they would be responsible for the engagement and communicating and actually addressing the issue of what's happening. And the other organizers would be doing, like I said, videotaping or rallying the people to come and participate in what's happening and observe the police. And, you know, beyond that, I think that, you know, the commissions are something that is going to be vital. And, you know, and I think in moving towards preparing to survive, or our survival depends on us, and in moving towards survival, the chairman mentioned earlier that this is a strategy to survive. This is not what we're looking at as a way of life. And as we move towards governing ourselves and as we move towards realizing the power that's necessary for us to live and reproduce real life, you know, this is a strategy that we prepare ourselves to deal with the struggles and the issues in the interim. And in preparing ourselves, we have to be able to deal with real questions as the imperialist crisis deepens, and, you know, they continue to fall apart. You know, what do we do when we can't go to Walmart Supercenter and buy food? You know, what do we do when you just can't go, you know, into the store and get your groceries? And that's, you know, one of the things I really appreciate about the community garden that was talked about, and really, you know, holding people accountable to having gardens in their backyard, and we begin to have somewhat of co-ops in our community. But next slide, please. But in lieu of some things, I have a couple of slides that gives us kind of ideas of, you know, when we caught in situations where we have to survive in the interim, or a strategy that we prepare, and we're not in a situation where, you know, the crisis deepens on a rapid basis and the store closes and we don't have anything. So we have to begin to look at alternatives and look at, you know, being prepared as we make this transition to power. And part of that is, like, even a survival kit, basic survival kit and first aid. And there's a list. I made several, I actually got several lists from various sites that touched on some things that I think are vital. And I put out some of the most important lists in those survival kits. Like, we have to be able to understand first aid and how to apply that. We have to, you know, make sure we have bandages and begin to collect bandages now, you know, while we can, you know, buying just bandages and stockpile them in a way to be able to, you know, meet the needs of the community in times of crisis. And other things is learning. They have a lot of classes, probably in most cities, that we can take even to learn certain survival techniques, learn how to administer first aid, learn how to do hemlock twigs and learn how to, you know, start a fire, campfire, and things like that, that we can learn that in lieu of no electricity, you know, and no alternative to power, how do we, you know, generate fire to cook food, and how do we do any of this stuff and make sure that and make sure that we are prepared to withstand that transition, be it a week, 2 weeks, a month, a year, whatever, you know, just being prepared. And it's better to be prepared and not have to use it than have to do it and not prepare. Next slide. And the next slide kind of gives an idea of like a 72-hour survival kit that most sites and even the preppers that I looked at that the chairman mentioned earlier, most them and other sites, you know, were saying that, you know, each individual needs like at least 1 gallon of water, 1 gallon of water per person. And this may, you know, sustain you in terms of the liquids in your system, unless you're active and that amount may increase. But the other thing is that we've got to be mindful in talking about preparedness in terms of survival, you know, in terms of a severe crisis, is also the kids and, you know, learning these things so you can make gains out of it for them to take some of the pressure and the stress that it would add to the struggle of, of the situation, but make it kind of fun for them they may enjoy camping or enjoy starting a fire, enjoy learning some of the skills that you learn, and you may find in survival kit books and Boy Scouts and stuff like that. But really preparing, you know, the youth to be able to deal with times like that. And I know maybe a couple of years ago here in Huntsville, the whole city and lost power for like a week. And they all the gas stations was closed, all the stores was closing and everything, and we didn't have electricity for like a week. And we actually just had some liquid lamps that we had with wicks. And, you know, but the kids thought it was a fun time, and the community really, really organized and came together and began to do different things, barbecued a lot more and stuff like that, and the community really pull together. And we have to begin to initiate that type of organizing in the community, where the community is coming together more and more to help each other meet its needs, so when these type of crises happen, it's not, we don't find ourselves in a situation where we at each other's throat trying to survive. Next slide. There's a few things that I saw, and I wanted to say too that as we learn more about some of the supplies and survival kits, because you find that some things that most people put in their survival kits, you know, may not be necessary or may lack something that we may need. And everybody has to, you know, develop a strategy to personalize their survival kit, because there are things that somebody else may not have an issue with, like insulin, like, you know, some dietary need that has to be met. So we want to make sure that, you know, even though there's certain staples that you have to have in a survival kit, that you don't forget about your own personal needs or the personal needs of somebody within your family or in the community that you know may need something in that particular time. And food for survival, you know, there's various type of, they have Thrive food sites and survival packs. One of the ones that I found most interesting was like the Mainstay emergency food ration, because it has like 9 bars in there and 2 bars a day per person, supposed to sustain you, you know, for the duration of that pack. And unless you're doing a lot of vigorous exercising or anything like that in the community, or you have to, the crisis that you were involved in caused you to be more mobile, you know, those are some good survival packs. Other things are like trail mix and protein bars are good to begin to stack up on. And next slide, please. The next couple of slides actually deal with lists of things that we can start stacking up on now, that you can start storing yourself, like right now when you go to the store. And you don't have to get necessarily everything at one time, but you can begin to purchase things, you know, that's in your everyday grocery list. And the ideal of some of these items is that they have a long shelf life. And like rice, pinto beans, you know, they may last, you know, months or even a few years if they're packaged right. And, you know, you want to get some of these items now and start stocking them up in your pantry, in your garage if you have one, and even, like I say, gallons of water that you can get, as well as something that is good to have is a purifying, some type of portable purifying system that can contribute to purifying water if necessary. Next slide. But like I said, the next few slides, like I said, is just items that you can go back and look at that talks about survival food, that adds flavor and comfort, the shelf life of those foods, hard grains, what hard grains you can get to have like a 10 to 12 year life, shelf life, soft grains, beans, you know, have 8 to 10 year life, shelf life, and you want to get these type of things because, you know, if you begin to stock up on food that is packaged, is either, you know, has a light package or even that is not that doesn't have a long shelf life, you'll open it up and think you're going to be able to eat, and you find like maggots in your food and stuff like that, and you don't have the ability to benefit from the work that you done stockpile. Next slide. And the next slide is just, it continues to just things that have long shelf life that can be staples and that you can make a lot of different things with, along with, you know, having the fishing tools that we talked to, that you saw in an earlier slide, where you can, you know, fish or hunt and you know, get food if you're not a vegetarian, and be able to, you know, have a full meal to go with that. And the next slide. The next slide, in terms of, you know, even just, like I said, in a lot of these classes, I think happens in most cities where you can take the classes and they come to wrong conclusion, but some of the information is helpful for us to begin to get the training to take back to our community, to prepare our community on how to deal with certain things. But the other thing about food for survival and is edible plants in our own backyard. And a lot of times we don't think about edible plants because, you know, we're not faced with certain contradictions, but, you know, you have plants even like dandelions that are actually edible plants that you can eat. And the other thing that we find is that there's some plants in the backyard that that are medicinal plants as well, that can be put on to healing sores and serve other medicinal purposes that we can actually benefit from. And that's something that in this process I would like for us to, as we learn more and we're able to put some of these plants in different regions that you can readily find, and even get seeds and plant in your own backyard if you don't have them, that we can readily find and actually put on some of our sites about, you know, what to eat and what not to eat in your backyard. And, you know, where we can really show, like, what is edible and what is medicinal for us in our backyard if we ever had to turn to that. The emergency stuff or the crisis. Next slide. And matter of fact, I just spoke with an expert here in Huntsville that is one of their passions and expertise is to identify edible plants in like in the wild and in your backyard, and as well as like medicinal plants in your backyard and just around the community. And we were talking about organizing a training like in late March, early April, here in Huntsville to actually train people, where he would train people on how to identify plants and know that if it's healthy to eat, or if it's a medicinal plant, or if it's something that you need to stay away from, and how to identify those plants. And we supposed to be talking this week to set up the exact